Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags, and over the next 30 minutes, we'll bring you the latest headlines from South Africa and around the globe. Whether you're tuning in live or catching the podcast later, stay with us for in-depth conversations with leading business minds, political influencers, and key newsmakers. It's everything you need to stay informed, quick, sharp, and straight to the point. It's Friday, the 11th of October. On the program today, are the Olympic Games an achievable reality for South Africa? Part two of my interview with the sports minister, Gayton McKenzie. How agribusiness can rise to the challenge of food security. Why did the Gauteng Department of Social Development return 554 million rand in unspent funds? And eThekwini is facing a severe water crisis with a new water rationing regime. Sports Minister Gayton McKenzie has confirmed to MoneyWeb that a top-level IOC meeting is to take place in South Africa shortly to discuss the possibility of us hosting the Olympic Games. I spoke to the minister in a two-part interview this week. Firstly, about the return of Formula One to South Africa, and now why he's chasing the holy grail of all sports events. This is what he told me.
Well, let me tell you, all I'm willing to say at this moment is that the president of the IOC is coming to South Africa at the end of this month, around the 20th, I think. Yes, Mr. Thomas Bach is coming to South Africa. So that's all I'm willing to say at this point, because I do not want to say more at this point.
What would be on the agenda of that meeting, Minister?
Jeremy, your old dog, you trying to me to answer the question. The agenda will be you will find out immediately after the discussions with the president of the IOC. He'll also be meeting the president of the country, His Excellency Cyril Ramaphosa. Will also meet with President Thomas Bach, and he will meet with SASCOC and different. He'll also meet with myself. The media will be invited. There will be a press conference thereafter.
Just one more question regarding the Olympic Games. What do you think went wrong for South Africa, and how are you going to fix the funding?
You know, for me, I just think that, you know, I must say it very loud. There are some, that it's just funding in sport in South Africa is extremely schizophrenic. What I'm saying is that, you know, the money is not being spent strategically. That's the word I'm looking for, strategically. Why am I saying that? I'm saying for a country of 60 million people, send 125 at least to the Olympics, I think that is underwhelming. It's not something to even celebrate. So what I want to do during my term is we are launching in the next 30 days of Project 300. Project 300 is not a government project. It's going to be run by the private sector. It's going to be outside government. Government is going to contribute money towards Project 300. The board members of Project 300 will be the people giving the money. The corporates, the 12 corporates that give the most money, will sit on that board. It is not a government project. It doesn't report to government. It is a body that must make sure that we identify talent, and that talent need to be nurtured. People make a mistake, Jeremy, where they think that sport is 50%. That's 100% on the field. No, it's 50% on the field, 50% off the field. Nutrition, mental health, socioeconomic conditions. That's why a lot of previously disadvantaged athletes don't make it. Because on the field, they give 100%. But off the field, circumstances disqualifies them to run the full Monty. So what I want to do is getting corporates, 12 corporates on a board, of Project 300, they will be managing their own money that they are giving. They will no longer be dependent solely on outside federations only. They will then tell them, listen, let's take a boy like Walaza. Walaza has been identified by Kuro. Kuro gave him an opportunity. He went, he got an Olympic silver medal. 1 hour to 2 hours before the Youth Olympics wanted to fly to, the Youth Championship wanted to fly to Peru. The flight was not paid for. Obviously, the sports minister was contacted, and I promised them I will help, and I did help to get at least there. On that same championship, two medals. He got two medals, gold in 100, gold in 200. We've got the fastest under 20-year-old in the world. Now, imagine if we didn't come up with that money. The whole team would not have gone. Now, what I'm saying to you is that we can't operate like this forever. So we bring Project 300. We want to take 300 athletes to the Olympics. We've spoken to people like Tatiana. We've spoken to a lot of people to say, the S1 Olympics of this world, athletes that made it on the national stage, to say, you must help us find and guide, not just find and guide our talent that we identify so that we can have 300 athletes going to Project 300. Right.
Minister,
for the Olympics.
Minister Gayton McKenzie, thank you very much indeed for talking to me today. I appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, Itakwini is facing a severe water crisis with new water rationing schemes set to begin, which I read could last for 7 years unless urgent action is taken. Now, despite efforts to reduce consumption, the city continues to lose more than half of its water supply due to leaks and theft. And with no major new water sources expected until after 2030, residents in Durban and businesses are being urged to use water sparingly. So today, I want to go a little more in depth into this and explore the challenges facing Itakwini and what needs to be done to secure the city's water future. And I'm joined now by Professor Faisal Bux, Director, Institute for Water and Wastewater Technology at the Durban University of Technology. Professor, good afternoon to you and a very warm welcome. These new water rationing measures that Itakwini has undertaken, what's your understanding and are they sufficient?
Thank you, Jeremy, and thank you for the opportunity. So let me give you some background at this stage. So the Department of Water and Sanitation is the custodian of water resources in South Africa. And the water utilities, in our case, Umgeni Uchukela Water, has a water use license, which actually determines how much of water they can extract from the dams. And recently, the Department of Water Sanitation asked Umgeni to reduce the volumes that they're abstracting from the dams. So in turn, Itakwini be the biggest customer of Umgeni Water. So Umgeni informed Itakwini that they're going to reduce the supply by approximately, I think, 8.4%. And in turn, Itakwini has now asked the consumers, the public at large, to reduce their consumption. So that is basically the history to what is being asked of the consumers here at the Itakwini in the municipality. Yeah.
Professor, do you think these measures are going to work?
You know, the low-hanging fruit. I mean, we know very well that our non-revenue water, basically water that is lost due to leaks, due to unbilled consumption and theft of water, is sitting at approximately 54% in the municipality. So the low-hanging fruit is for us and for the municipality to address the non-revenue water rates. I mean, we're sitting with 54%, which is way more than what the national average is for non-revenue water. It is way more than what the global average is for many metros throughout the world. So in my opinion, I would say that Itakwini municipality needs to address the non-revenue water issue very urgently, put resources in place, get the skilled personnel to ensure that we plug the leaks. That should be the first thing that should have been done rather than it impacting now on the end users.
And fundamentally, Professor, it is a political issue. Do you think that the municipality, the authorities, have the capacity, the wherewithal, and even the appetite to do what you're suggesting?
Unfortunately, it doesn't look like that at this stage. There isn't any or sufficient evidence to suggest that enough is being done to solve the non-revenue water issue. And I'll give you an example. I think in around 2009, non-revenue water was sitting at 32%. Now in 2023, we're sitting at non-revenue water rates of 58 sin. And that is completely unacceptable. I mean, they had enough time to plan going ahead and invest resources required to fix pipes, to fix the leaks, to do adequate maintenance of the distribution networks all the way from the reservoirs up to your house. So I feel more should have been done in that regard.
Professor, leaks are one issue, but what is more concerning is the theft. How is that happening and how widespread is it?
Well, it's hard for me to comment on that aspect right now. I do not have enough data in that regard. But from according to what's being mentioned out there, 60% of your non-revenue water is largely lost because of leaks. And the balance could be attributed to unmetered billing, possibly from informal settlements and illegal connections to your water network, which is a large amount. And, clearly that needs to be addressed as well. We all say, yes, fine, non-revenue water, but also on the side of the end users, the public at large as well, there needs to be, some sort of behavioral changes on trying to reduce the water consumptions per household.
Professor, if the Metro might have water rationing for the next 7 years, what does that say about long-term planning?
Certainly it's going to be substantial impact on the public at large, on the economy of the city. Tourism being a major money spinner for Durban, and it certainly is going to have substantial impact. But there are talks about the Umkomazi Dam that's been in planning stage for many, many years. And they're talking about that dam alleviating some of the water challenges that we're facing in the city. And hopefully they can expedite the construction of the dam and get it online ASAP. Certainly that will help alleviate the problems that we're facing. But major, major concern to me is the non-revenue water. We need to put adequate measures in place to ensure that that's reduced substantially so that the impact on the ground is not felt by the public at large and industry and the commerce side of the city, which is seriously could be impacted upon.
And the reality of the situation is for the foreseeable future, communities and often marginalized communities and business are going to have to respond to these restrictions. It's going to be increasingly difficult to do so. It's going to be a very, very hard time ahead.
Absolutely. It's very unfortunate. I mean, I think it's going to be effective from today, the 10th of October. And I don't know. I do not have details as to how they're going to go about doing it, the logistics behind implementing these water restrictors on our meters. I do not have details on that. But certainly the impact can be substantial. Some people have been quoting like reducing volumes by 50% at your meter by putting in these restrictors. So I hope that doesn't happen, but I hope the municipality can try and reduce the impact substantially, because we'll be heading towards the holiday season as well. So
indeed,
good impact.
Whichever way you look at it, it is a very serious situation for a very large and important province. Professor Faisal Bucks, thank you very much indeed. Director, Institute for Water and Wastewater Technology at DUT. I do appreciate your time. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday. For all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's gender-based violent shelters are facing a dire crisis, with underfunding and bureaucratic delays leaving many unable to provide essential services. It's a real problem. Now, all of this despite the Gauteng Department of Social Development having to return 554 million rand in unspent funds. The upshot, shelters are still struggling to stay operational and survivors of GBV are being turned away. I want to discuss that in some detail now, the challenges facing these shelters, the impact of the underfunding and what needs to change to protect the most vulnerable. And joining me now is Anisa Musa, who is National Coordinator for the National Shelter Movement of South Africa. Anisa, good afternoon to you and a very warm welcome. The Gauteng Department of Social Development returning 550 million rand in unspent funds. How did this come to be?
Good afternoon to all the listeners out there. Thank you for having me on, Mr. Maggs. I think it's an important topic. That's the confusion that we all having difficulty trying to understand, considering that the GBV sector in particular, along with disability, child protection, all of those other sectors, are struggling and unable to meet the demands. And I mean, in a nutshell, this is monies taken from essential support services, decreasing our the quality of services and even the stability, which overall has a direct impact on vulnerability altogether. So to answer your question, it's very confusing for us how money can be returned when there's so many needs on the ground.
And have you had an opportunity, or will you have an opportunity, to ask the department how this happened?
Well, we hope so. We've been trying to have several meetings, engagements with the department. I think overall we struggle with transparency. Communication is a bit of an issue, particularly around responsiveness. So we don't get immediate responses. We go from pillar to post. There's some engagement. I think we're trying to be optimistic about the communications. We're hoping that long term, some positive changes will be made with all the efforts from organizations like the National Shelter Movement of South Africa, particularly around the gender-based violence sector, and each of the representatives in the other sectors, including the Gauteng Care Crisis Committee.
Anisa, could we wrap some more numbers around this? Could you give me a sense of how many shelters there are in the province and how many people are potentially affected?
Okay, so we're looking at 22 shelters that are registered with the NSM in Gauteng. That, for one, is generally in the sector we struggle with numbers, because that's not enough shelters anyway in the country. So we have a shortage of shelters, right? So when we cut funds, it also means that on the existing resources, we cannot deliver the full extent of services. Numbers of beneficiaries is hard to say in terms of the number of years, but the capacity then inevitably gets reduced with the funding cuts. So each shelter would have its own admission capacity, depending on the size, depending on the number of programs, depending on the number of shelters that they registered for and that they get funding for.
And could you explain to me practically how the most vulnerable are impacted? How do their lives change?
Okay, so I'm just going to go through, the direct implications of funding cuts quickly. And when it comes to shelters not being able to take admissions, new admissions, which means that women who really need assistance don't get that, which again increases their risk to domestic violence. It's also life-threatening for them. We cannot provide safe spaces for them the way shelters was intended to. Services get suspended, which means that they, along with admission, some of the programs, because remember that shelters don't only provide accommodation. They save lives, but they also help to break the cycle of abuse and they help women to move forward after leaving an abusive relationship. So it could include legal support, it could include psychosocial services, medical care. So all those, because of lack of funds, they're not able to provide those services. Then we also look at the operations that are reduced. Little things like transport to resources around the shelter, availability of beds, cutbacks on critical services, like I mentioned now. That's not even mentioning staff burnout, despondence, turnover. So, if you look at the implications of that, they're quite widespread and far-reaching for the sector, in a sense that there's no uncertainty. There's no security, job security. We don't even know how far we're going to function on a functional level, operational level. Making decisions.
So there's a litany of consequences you outlined.
Definitely.
Very quickly then, what in your opinion in the short term needs to change for shelters to operate effectively and sustainably? Is there a quick way to resolve this?
Right. So we do need increases in current subsidies, because as it is, even the subsidies that we're getting are not meeting our needs, right? Then funds need to be disbursed promptly. We need to overcome bureaucratic hurdles like issues related to compliance, and we need the support of the department when it comes to getting shelters compliant, which is another topic on its own. And then clarity on why funds were returned, like you asked very earlier, because we don't have those answers. But also, I think, and I mentioned before, when it comes to responsiveness, we need the department to be more responsive, communicate better with us. We need to start seeing that our SLAs, our service level agreements, are conducive to adequate and effective service delivery, and we need to start seeing that to be reflected in the budgetary provisions. And like I mentioned, we need increases right. in subsidies. We also need stability, long-term stability in funding security. Because every year now, this is going on for 2 years, where organizations are unclear as to where they stand when it comes to funding. So we need to put into place measures to ensure that every 3 months, every 6 months, every year, organizations are not in a panic about whether we're going to be able to keep our doors open. And I think overall, there has to be that recognition and acknowledgement that the GBV sector, along with services to all more marginalized groups, are a priority. And I think up until that doesn't happen, we're going to struggle.
Anisa Musa, I'm going to leave it there. A very complex and a very difficult problem. I do appreciate your time. National Coordinator for the National Shelter Movement of South Africa. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa is facing a critical challenge in its agriculture sector, with up to 20 million citizens experiencing severe food insecurity. To address these issues, South African farmers must now adopt innovative approaches and technologies to increase food production while maintaining sustainability. There's a real balance there. And I want to focus on how agribusiness can rise to this challenge of food security, and maybe what new strategies are on the horizon to ensure both increased output and sustainable practice. And to that end, agribusiness leader at PwC Africa, Andrew Dale, is with me. Andrew, good afternoon to you and a warm welcome. First of all, maybe let's just start with why food insecurity has become such a pressing issue.
Good afternoon, Jeremy, to you and your listeners. So, yeah, it's become really significant. If you look at the number of challenges that we've experienced in South Africa, we've had these rising interest rates for a long time. We've had a lot of inflation impact and, challenges around the whole job market and people that are basically aren't employed for working opportunities. So all of that has had really an impact on everyone's wallet. And you'll see that there's also been quite a large decrease, around about 3% decrease in terms of food that was purchased in the last financial year. So we've seen that there's definitely been a lot of pressure on the consumers.
20 million people is almost a third of South Africa's population. Is this figure getting worse, do you think?
I think it is getting worse, but there is a couple of silver linings in terms of what's happening in the country. I mean, after the elections and a lot of sort of investment opportunities, and we're hoping that that will create a lot more job opportunities to, improve on the unemployment levels. And, inflation is starting to come under control and interest rates are declining. So we hope that there will be some improvement. But it does need a lot of work because it's a significant number of people.
Well, part of that new work, I would imagine, revolves around technology, Andrew. And it's critical that the sector now starts to embrace technology to improve efficiency and sustainability. In what respect, and is that happening quick enough?
So it's starting to happen. I think what's important is initially there was the whole threat that technology would replace people. And I think what we've seen is that it's more a case of people that embrace technology and that understand the technology will replace people that are not moving with the technology. So I think that is a very important focus with regards to upskilling and knowing how to use that technology to better enhance your business.
But not always easy for a smaller or medium-sized farm.
No, it is not easy. But I think what's important to understand is that, you know, when you're looking at your commercial farms, there's a lot of organizations, for example, your different agricultural co-ops that are there to support the farmers. They have large sort of farming support services within their setups. They have a lot of access to the data. And, you know, working with those farmers, the farmers can start to get used to using that technology better in their business. And I think there, you know, also lies quite a few opportunities as well.
Andrew, PwC also makes the point about the importance of end-to-end farm management for modern agriculture. What is that and why is it important?
So for us, it is extremely important that you start looking into your business and how do you professionalize your business and how do you gear yourself up for the different types of threats that your business will face. And when we talk about your sort of end-to-end business, it comes down to things like managing the finance processes within the business and the risks that impact on your finances, how to manage your supply chain management processes in order to get the best sort of value for money, and then also to make sure that you're working with the correct customers to supply, and then also how to deal with your resources and apply the principles of precision farming, that you utilize those resources, in other words, getting the best output from the most effective input that you apply on your business. So these are just some of the examples, as well as things like compliance management. So there's a number of areas within a farming business setup that can also then improve from this different sort of data inputs that are available.
And Andrew, no one's doubting the importance of sustainable practice when it comes to modern agriculture, but surely it becomes difficult to balance sustainability with pressure on output.
Yes, no, it definitely does. But I think as long as you've got that additional data and you're doing the right things, you do put yourself in that position to be successful. And what you've also just picked up, you know, one of the points that we're talking about is in terms of the family business and how do they evolve from generation to generation. And there's a lot of work that needs to be brought into these family businesses to sort of professionalize them and gear them up to grow to be a very successful commercial farming practice.
That's so interesting, because you're suggesting, I imagine, that succession planning for family-owned farms isn't always done properly, and that is when you're in that middle ground, when there's a changeover happening, that can have a severe impact on the business, and again, the domino effect is output again.
Definitely. Yeah, it's a big focus, because often that succession happens when you have the initial farmer potentially passing in the business, because they don't normally just retire, that they continue to do that. And you need to have a family constitution in place in order to determine how the succession will take place, when it will take place, how do we bring professionals into the business, and also sort of what roles will the family play in that business, if any. And all these things need to be planned up front, and you need to have those hard conversations. Otherwise, the business is going to struggle to be successful from generation to generation.
Well, that is the changing face of agriculture in South Africa. Andrew Dale, PwC Africa Agribusiness Leader, thank you very much for joining me today. I appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And that's our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays, then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.